Gotta pay the tab.
You gotta pay the tab.
Hi, I'm Tony Tolbert.
And I'm Adam Radinsky.
Welcome to Pay the Tab, where we make the case for reparations, one story at a time.
Each episode, we expose a story of racial injustice. Then we explore creative ways to make it right.
It's been long enough, America. It's time to pay the tab.
So, wow, reparations are just in the air these days. It's incredible. You turn on the news or talk to somebody, and it seems like you can't go a day without hearing something about the fight for reparations.
Yeah, that's without a doubt. It's in the air. It's in the water. It's a hot topic for sure, but it's not a new topic, right? So let's not be fooled about that. You know, we've been here before.
Definitely. It's not at all a new topic. In fact, the fight for Black reparations goes back to at least the 1800s. But there's at least one time when there was a successful movement for reparations against the U.S. government, where it was forced to pay out cash and apologize for its own racist atrocities.
Yep.
In 1988, more than 80,000 Japanese Americans received reparations from the U.S. government for being illegally rounded up and put into prison camps during World War II. It's part of our country's history that's been definitely sugar-coated and mostly just swept under the rug.
Yeah, so we're excited to be joined today by two dynamic leaders who are going to help break down what really happened, right? The real history of these prison camps and the long fight for reparations that followed.
Yep.
So more than 120,000 Japanese Americans were rounded up and placed in these prison camps in a totally illegal and bogus move. You know, the claim at the time was that you needed to be careful. We were at war. And so there's, you know, folks posed a wartime security threat. And that was just, you know, BS, right? And later was, you know, came out that this was just a straight land grab, that there were a lot of white farmers who were jealous of Japanese Americans who were making, you know, great strides with their land, in many cases land that was underdeveloped. And this was a chance for the white farmers to actually grab some of that land. So yeah, we're gonna explore the fight for redress, what happened, and the racial solidarity that was so important in that fight, the alliances between Japanese American and African Americans at the time. And look at what, you know, victory means in this context. Even though the redress was far from perfect, it was something meaningful and something that the government actually did.
Yeah, and we want to be real clear here. This is a very, very different situation from Black American reparations. And, you know, the prison camps were for 3 years. It was not like the 400 years of slavery and Jim Crow and all the racism since then. But, you know, it is still a great example of pushing our government hard and basically forcing the government to pay some money, to make redress, to apologize, and to have a public airing of what really happened. And this story will show us that, you know, reparations can be done here in America.
So, folks, this is another live episode with a great crowd at the Greenway Court Theater. We learned a lot of untold history and reparation strategy from our two amazing guests, the dynamic duo of Kathy Masuoka and Tracy Kato Kiriyama. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Greenway Court Theater. My name is Muhammad Ojadagi. I'm the producing director. This is going to be great, fantastic, and I'm just so, so excited about this. And without further ado, I would like to bring your hosts, Tony Tolbert and Adam Radinsky of Pay the Tab.
Make some noise if you're feeling good. And make some more noise if you're ready for a show that's going to feed your mind and feed your soul. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Right on. It's great to be here. Great to see everybody here. Excuse my back and my side, but yeah. So we are going to jump this off. And I'm Tony Tolbert. This is Adam Radinsky. We are the co-hosts of Pay the Tab, Reparations Now. We are two lawyers making the case for reparations. And reparations now. There has never been more conversation in the history of this country about reparations than what's going on today. I actually literally just stumbled into a reparations festival happening in Leimert Park today. I was out doing some walk, you know, doing some errands, and I saw a sign that said reparations now. I was like, okay, that looks kind of interesting. Let me check that out. And sure enough, it was a whole thing going on. So there's momentum, there's an energy moving in that direction, and we are really excited about doing whatever we can to spark conversation, spark thought around the issue of reparations. Right, so let me take a moment to give a land acknowledgement. Right, we want to acknowledge our presence on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Gabrielina Tongva peoples. We pay our respects to the ancestors, elders, and relations, past, present, and emerging. And we ask all of us to consider what would it mean to fully acknowledge our presence and take responsibility for our presence on stolen land.
So welcome, everybody. We're really glad to see you all here and hear you. 35 years ago this week, on August 10th, 1988, the United States government did something very unusual. It apologized and also paid money for one of its racist atrocities. We are thrilled to be joined today by two national leaders on the connections between Japanese-American reparations in the 1980s and the current movement for black reparations.
Kathy Masaoka was born and raised in Boyle Heights and came of age during the late 60s. Since 1971, she has worked on issues related to youth, workers, and housing in Little Tokyo, and redress for Japanese Americans. As co-chair of Nikkei for Civil Rights and Redress, NCRR, she served on the editorial team for the book NCRR, The Grassroots Struggle for Japanese American Redress and Reparations. Yes. Kathy's activism includes building solidarity in support of reparations for African Americans. So she's a retired teacher from an LAUSD continuation school. She retired in 2011. She lives in LA, Tongva Land, with her husband, Mark Masaoka. They have a daughter, Mayumi, a son, Dan, and three grandsons. So please give it up for Kathy Masaoka. Yeah. And just as a quick aside, that festival that I stumbled my way into today, I bumped into Kathy there. So I know I must be living right.
Yeah, we're also honored to welcome Tracy Kato-Kiriyama. Tracy is an award-winning multidisciplinary artist recognized for their work as writer, performer, theater divisor, cultural producer, community organizer, and audiobook narrator. Tracy is author of the amazing Navigating Without Instruments, Poetry, Micro-Essays, and Notes to Self, which will also be available after the show. They also co-chair the National Nikkei Reparations Coalition and are a member of the Why We Can't Wait Coalition. So please help us welcome Tracy Kato-Kiriyama.
All right, so we're here today to talk about the connection between the Japanese-American movement for reparations that was successful largely and the current reparations movement for black Americans. There are some parallels and some links, and so we're going to explore that. First, we'll give you a little bit of history about what happened back in the 40s. So in February of 1942, FDR issued Executive Order 9066, which authorized the removal of people who were deemed a threat to national security, removal from the West Coast, and they were moved to relocation centers, euphemistically named, further inland. To date, it's the largest single act of mass incarceration in U.S. history. Approximately 125,000 Japanese folks were incarcerated. At the time, it was virtually the entire Japanese-American population in the country. And they were held in these concentration camps from 1942 to 1945. Camps were in 10 cities throughout California, five other western states, and Arkansas. Just a real tragedy that was largely swept under the rugs and not talked about and certainly not discussed. And most folks who grew up in California or anywhere learning history This was not included in that. So we're gonna dig into that. So first question, for this is for you, Kathy. You know, there are various, you know, reasons as to, you know, why these actions were taken, at least the reasons that the government said. So what are some of the reasons that the government stated for taking these drastic and unprecedented steps?
One of them is what you said already, which is that they saw the Japanese-American community as a threat. That's what they said. Pearl Harbor had been bombed, and you know, now there was a military necessity to watch out for Japanese-Americans who might be considered supporting or helping the Japanese government, the fifth column kind of thing. Some of the things the government said was that it was for our own protection, and they employed a group called the Japanese-American Citizens League to sort of spread that word, and that it was, you know, for our own protection.
For your own protection.
Own protection, cooperate with the government. It's almost your duty, patriotic duty, to do this. So they had some support within the community from an organization like that. And when people actually went to the camp, some of the propaganda films they showed people getting off of these buses in very desolate areas and saying, these are new pioneers in a new land.
Wow.
You know,
yeah.
And that will start a new life.
So, now, and on that first point about being a threat, it's our understanding that no Japanese American was convicted of espionage, sabotage before, during, or after the war. Is that correct?
That's correct. Right.
Got it.
Yeah.
And also that the government pretty much knew that this was a bogus pretext, right?
Exactly.
And we'll get into that. But
that's right. That's
yeah.
Right.
So, Tracy, you know, maybe you can get us started on some of the real reasons for this action.
Yeah. Greed. Capitalism. White supremacy. Anti-Asian hate, right? I think, you know, we were prepping for today, we were kind of going back into the history banks and writing down a bunch of different dates. And, you know, of course, we always talk about how this did not happen because of Pearl Harbor, right? The plans were set for quite a while. And the lobbying that was happening was also standing on the shoulders of other laws that were being passed from before the 1900s, right? The Chinese Exclusion Act. There was a group called the Asiatic Exclusion League in San Francisco that was formed in 1905. These were all different groups that were trying to keep California white. There were campaigns in the Bay Area. We think of San Francisco, you know, as being super progressive,
liberal.
Doesn't have that history, you know? So there were, I think, of the largest groups to lobby for the camps and the removal of Japanese and Japanese Americans from the West Coast, those were other farmers who looked at the fact that there were 40% of all the farms in California being occupied, leased, and run by Japanese and Japanese American families. They wanted that. They wanted that land.
Wanted the land, yeah.
Yeah. So, and these were all very powerful people. They were not just like rogue groups. They were very much so working alongside people who were mayor, you know, of different cities, running different newspapers. So they all, and the media, of course, fed into all of that.
And there was like some jealousy that had been built up over time, right? I mean, this wasn't like just all of a sudden.
For sure. Because there were, you know, a lot of Japanese farmers, like, you know, some of our own grandparents. They were taking up land that was very kind of desolate, or the soil wasn't seen as valuable, but they were able to really get in there, irrigate in a different way, and really grow these patches of land into really successful strawberry fields. I mean, I could go on and on in terms of the kinds of produce that
right.
they
grew. There was a lot of jealousy,
grew.
A lot of just
yeah, there were a lot of people who felt that it was wrong that the Japanese were even able to do that kind of farming. And sharecropping.
Yeah. And you know, none of this is taught, of course, in our schools. And well, we want to ask you guys a little bit about, because one thing that is also not taught in the books is about sort of the conditions of the camps. And there's a lot of myths about, you know, that the conditions were pretty good, actually. But we've heard that the conditions were just horrendous and all kinds of problems. Do you want to maybe either of you give us some examples of just what it was like?
So all of these places were really in areas that were not desirable. The land was not, the area was not, it was very hot or very cold, things like that in the winter. And I think the conditions, and they lived in barracks, mm-hmm. you know, that were about 20 by 20. They had a family, 20 people, and it was divided up. So families were cramped into these areas. But I think the biggest thing is that the families were really, it destroyed family life. So you had mess halls, people lined up, the lines lined up for everything. So they lined up for food, and they eventually families didn't eat together. So it was like, you know, the young people ate with each other, they ran from mm-hmm. mess hall to mess hall to eat. So the whole authority of the parents kind of diminished, the unity of the family kind of broke down. Mm-hmm. You know, so things like that, it would just kind of destroy that kind of thing.
Turning to your families, you know, it'd be great if you could share with the audience, who in your family was incarcerated, you know, where, and just give some sense of what you know of their experience.
You know, my family, my father's family was at Manzanar. They came right. from Boyle Heights, had a market, went to Manzanar. Mm-hmm. My mother's family were farmers in Santa Maria, and they were taken to Gila River, Arizona, on the land of the Gila River indigenous people, who didn't want the camp there. So that's where they were put.
And I think when we had lunches a few months ago now, you'd mentioned that your family actually tried to get out, right? I mean, tried to flee to Texas, I think it was. Is that right?
People had a short window of time where they could relocate.
Right.
And so they tried to find enough cars. There were a family of 10 children and my grandmother, and they needed more than one car. And they did have a relative in Texas, so they tried to round up some, you know, transportation, couldn't do it in time.
So did some of your family members, were they able to actually flee to Texas? Or
No. Okay. They all stayed together.
Got it.
Mm.
Yeah.
How about you, Tracy?
Yeah, so my mother's side were all taken to Manzanar, and also my dad's, both the Kato and Kiriyama sides of the family. There was my dad's oldest brother, who he never met. He was born and raised and had a family in Japan. My dad was the youngest of nine. So outside of his oldest brother, everybody else was here. So they all went to Manzanar. And then when the loyalty questionnaire came up later, my dad's dad signed no. So then they were sent to Tule Lake at the northern end of California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So if you could help us understand what was the impact? Like, how were your families impacted? What were some of the losses that were suffer tangible and otherwise?
Yeah. You know, for my my mother's family, the farm, they didn't own it, although that's in dispute. They had to lease it because they couldn't own land, right?
We're not legally allowed to own land.
Right. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather was picked up by the FBI. And what I learned just recently was that he was taken to Griffith Park as a sort of a substation of Tuna Canyon, where he was processed in like 2 days. So he's picked up. And taken in 1 day in Santa Barbara jail, and the 2 days in Griffith Park, and immediately whisked away to Bismarck, North Dakota. So the family had no idea. They had no idea that he was even in Griffith Park or Tuna Canyon. Wow. They just knew he went to Bismarck. They had no chance to find out. But I also found out that the area, the Santa Barbara County, where there were four major neighbor areas or communities of Japanese Americans, that 265 first-generation men were picked up in about 2 or 3 days. February 19th, 1942 was one of the days. And that represented over 10% of the population, which means that every single family
was impacted
by that roundup. It was second biggest roundup, they said, on the West Coast. So it was like, why was that so critical?
Right.
And it goes back to the farms. You know, they're all farmers, you know.
You both described how chaotic it was, too. There's like no notice, and no one knows what's going on. Yeah. People are trying to get their property and their money and not able to. And
yeah, bank accounts were frozen. Most people never saw their belongings, their property again. There were, you know, some cases where a neighbor or friend was able to watch their property or their business. But in most cases, like my family's came back to nothing. And then all of our families have stories about those weeks and months before being sent away where folks would in the neighborhood would come over and just want things for pennies. So, you know, lots of stories about people just like saying, forget that, and just went and buried it. I just found out from my brother, I didn't know this, but my grandma did that. She buried in near Sawtelle, they were West LA family, of the things that she just couldn't fathom selling, she buried it.
Wow. Wow.
But it's not a house anymore. It's some huge building. I can't go and be like, can I dig up your foundations? And so we're left with all of these wonderings.
Yeah.
What did they bury? What did they lose?
So, Tracy, you're going to share a piece, right?
Yeah. When I was thinking about that idea of loss, my mom told me this story about how she was 2 to 5 years old in camp. Mm-hmm. And so she was really young. She only remembers certain things like dust and tumbleweeds and things like that. So her memories are more about the resettlement period. And she said that her parents never talked about it. And she always figured, well, it was because everybody was just busy surviving and that they didn't think about it anymore. Mm. And then in the late 50s, my grandfather's nursery, it was like his third nursery trial at that point, it got taken with eminent domain to build the Crenshaw exit off the 405 freeway. And that's when he kind of lost it. Mm. Mm. And he just kept saying the word again.
Mm.
And he was so angry, and my mom finally was like, "Oh, you were, you are angry about what happened back during the war."
Mm, mm.
And so when I think about that, like I, sort of fast forwarding to, like the redress movement, I think about my grandfather a lot because he died in 78, so he died well before. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to share this. This is dedicated to all the ancestors who died before knowing that redress and reparations would be a thing to come or to be fought for in the future we call now. This is called No Redress. No museum, no monument, no poem, no song can house the spirit of a past soul like that of my grandfather, who died before justice could meet the old man at his mailbox. Grandpa never got to stand in line at the bank, 3 inches taller, with redress check in hand, 1 foot in front of the other, feeling grounded again. Never got to deposit an apology in his savings account. Never got to wonder of how he might spend this money on new equipment for the nursery, or a truck for himself, or college money for his grandchildren, or for once take the most takai cuts from the fish truck man. Most years in April, I attend pilgrimage. I say hello, Manzanar. I bow at the graves. I speak to the wind of my hopes for afterlife to be a real thing. Not so I can see Grandpa again, but for him to look around today, jump into the circle, dance the tonkobushi and watch me get it right, and see our friends, all our relations, learn what we mean by chosen family. We are here, not only to remember, but to remind the local docents, this place will never be a museum. This body will never forget. And we leave pilgrimage with pledges as concrete as the monument. We sing songs to keep each other awake on the long ride home. We lose sight quickly. Rearview mirrors, a pitch black sky, where they close the gate at the hour they have had enough of us. Where we leave behind parts of our best poetry, where I hope not, but think Grandpa sits still, waiting.
Mm. Mm.
So. So I think about loss that keeps rearing its head even after his death, right?
Mm.
And Kathy, you said a similar thing, that after the war, you know, the older generation didn't talk about what happened, and it was not a thing. And obviously, you became active in the movement for redress back in the 60s and 70s, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can just tell us a little bit about, what initially brought you into that movement and making a break with, the older generation.
Yeah, I come from that generation that was born a few years or just right about end of the camps.
Mm-hmm.
And so our families were all getting ready, just trying to rebuild their lives. And for many of them, they didn't really want to look back. They didn't really have time to look back. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if they even were able to synthesize or think about, you know, how what that was all about. They just had to move on. And I don't even know if they could have figured out how to explain it to us growing up. So they never talked about the camp in my family, and many families like mine, although some did, you know, mine did not. And so we grew up not knowing about the camps and not really understanding who we were as Japanese Americans.
Japanese American groups were lobbying hard and taking it to Washington, and I know that was difficult because it's far away for one thing. But it sounds like during about that decade of the 70s, there was all this work going on. And then I guess it was 1980 was finally the U.S. Congress formed a commission, right, on wartime relocation and internment.
Yeah, I wouldn't say we were doing a lot in the 70s. It was kind of like, you know, towards the end of the 70s, people were talking about it. We were very lucky. Well, I wouldn't say lucky, but go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Keep going.
I was going to say we were lucky in a way that this commission was proposed. At the time, we thought it was a terrible idea because we said, we know a wrong was committed. What the hell do you need a commission?
To tell us what we already know.
Yeah, to go around and find out if a wrong was committed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it turned out to be the best thing, and it came early in the movement, you know, because we formed in 1980, and then 1981, August, or June, July, you know, there were hearings across the country. That didn't come easily. We pushed for hearings to be held in cities where Japanese Americans were so they can speak for themselves.
Right, yeah. So it was a 10-city tour in 1981. Hearings included testimonies of over 750 people, many of whom had been incarcerated, others who were impacted in different ways. Cities included L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, New York, Chicago, D.C., Boston.
Yeah, it took a lot of work. It took a lot of work to encourage people to begin to talk about it. They had buried it so deep. Right. And Tracy could talk more about this because, you know, of her work around the hearings. But, you know, it was very hard. And it opened up a lot of wounds. And some people never were able to do that, really.
Sure.
But then you ended up packing the hearing room, right?
That's right. And people were there. Even if they didn't testify, they were there.
And then once people started hearing testimonies, right?
Yeah, so the best thing about the hearings is the fact that we didn't hear these stories before, like I said, we never heard them. So hearing from all of these people, it was...
For the first time you were
here. For the first time. We were like mesmerized. We wanted to be there all the time to listen to all of it. And you know, it was a thing that changed us.
As that kind of unexpected.
Totally.
They had to add an evening because more people wanted to testify.
Wow. So the hearings in L.A. were like three days?
Three days and one evening. The evening was also added because we knew, because our movement was about grassroots movement and it was about working people, and working people couldn't come in the daytime.
Because they got to work.
So the hearings were in the evening and those were, you know, some good hearings, testimonies.
Yeah, they always say that one of the biggest things with any reparations movement is to get the truth out there and people be able to tell their stories, which sometimes we might take for granted if we think people might already know some things, but here people didn't even know what was happening and what had happened. And it sounds like it was super powerful. Is there anything you wanted to add, Tracy, about the hearings before we...
I mean, I was a kid when they were happening, so I didn't really know about them until later. And I'm excited that we're going to get to see a clip because when I saw it, I was, I think, in college, and it was at a museum, and... They had selections of the testimonies of the Los Angeles hearings, and it was just on loop. And I stood there for so long, just watching it over and over. And I was mesmerized, and I was stunned at seeing people who looked like my aunties and uncles and grandparents, like speaking so passionately, so eloquently. They were mad. They were crying, like. None of the tropes I had ever received in media about our people. You know what I mean? I was like, what is happening? And I knew they were doing this in front of people. And you could tell it was like a book cracking open. It's like that first time where the voice is cracking because they're saying these words for the first time out loud. And so it was incredible. So, yeah.
Well, we're going to play a short video for you all. So we will clear away so you can see the screen.
My name is Martha Okamoto. Sorry, I help you. I will try very hard, excuse me. My brother, as regards to my brother James, was killed at Manzanar. I have never been able to talk about this, but more people have come up to me and said I must speak up. My children, even my own children, don't know that my brother was shot in the back.
On December 7, 1941, we were the only Japanese-American family on Kodiak, in Kodiak, Alaska. In a short time, my father and two uncles were arrested and put in concentration camps in the United States. We were not told where they were sent. They lost all their property, their house, their boats, equipment, and everything. I have never seen my father since. I have been trying to find him, been trying to locate him. And what happened to him, I don't know, and have been unsuccessful so far. I am very bitter about this. I have not seen my father since I was 11 years old. I am now 51 years old. I have missed my father very much. And I wonder, I wonder if he's alive today.
On a personal basis, I sincerely appreciate what you've done. We're not talking on a personal basis right now. So you're trying to hurry me. And I will not be hurried by you as a representative of this government. Well, now you want me to leave. You can tell me to leave.
No, I'm not telling. There's no point in getting...
Well, don't rush us.
No, I'm not trying to rush you. As a matter of fact, I think if
I've
you're...
been rushed by this government enough.
Well, sir, I want to assure
if
you...
If you didn't want this position, you volunteered for it.
Well,
So you know what some of these old men said? The old men said, hey, they're feeding us because we're going to die. They're going to kill us. You know, just like the execution chamber before you die. Yeah, that's what he said. So, but that's why I thought, no. This country ain't going to do that kind of stuff, man. You know, it's a democratic country, Bill of Rights, constitutional, and all that. They just go with it, see? But they're not going to do that. This is democracy. You know what one woman say? No, this is not democracy. This is Democrat shit, he said. He said, so, by God, maybe this guy, he got a point, I said. No, he might have been right. And then we get off the train. When we got off the train,
As a clinician in the field of mental health, I tried to understand why so many Americans, Japanese and otherwise, were able to justify, rationalize, and deny the injustice and the destructiveness of the whole event. I have come to the realization that we lulled ourselves into believing the propaganda of the 1940s so that we could maintain our idealized image of a benevolent, protective Uncle Sam. We were told that we were being put away for our own safety. We were told that this was a patriotic sacrifice necessary for national security. The pain, trauma, and stress of the incarceration experience was so overwhelming. We used the psychological defense mechanisms of repression, denial, and rationalization to keep us from facing the truth. The truth was that the government we trusted, the country we loved, the nation to which we had pledged loyalty, had betrayed us, had turned against us. Our natural human feelings of rage, fear, and helplessness were turned inward and buried. No one benefits when truth is silent. The bigots and uninformed demagogues and persecutors will become increasingly suppressive and abusive, attempting to diminish our characters through crude jokes and half-truths. I will be proud to be a Japanese, and I would want to be equally proud to be an American. I do hope my late father's ideals and expectations for this country will someday be realized.
Wow.
Yeah.
You all have seen that clip several times, right?
Mm-hmm. We've seen many clips.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah. Many times.
Many times.
And what, if you don't mind sharing, what's the, even after seeing it many times, what's the impact?
It's still very emotional, yeah. And especially I want to pay respects to one of the people that's in the video. It's Jim Matsuoka, who passed away in October. Mm-hmm. He was he's one that banged his hand, fist on the table, and really kind of guided us a lot. He was, as we say, our North Star, very wise, you know, very angry at times, but always learning, you know, and always involved, and somebody we all miss a lot. You
and
know?
He would come onto our reparations committee calls all the way till the end.
Wow.
And there's a video, if you go on the Nikkei Progressive's Instagram, there's a video of Jim talking about his really adamant support for Black reparations now. What's that like for y'all to see it?
Good question.
Emotional.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is maybe the third or fourth time I've seen it myself. But yeah, I was, you know, just trying to keep it together over there. Just the outrage, the pain, the shame, the experience of having, for folks to have endured that at the hands of our government is, it's just, it's maddening and saddening both at the same time.
Yeah, and real human emotion and storytelling is what can really bring it to life. For me, it's just shocking and realizing that, you know, how I knew nothing, and still know very, very little, you know? Yeah, Tony mentioned the pseudo-apology that was sort of built into this bill, and Reagan, who wanted to veto the bill, and the political pressure was just such that they said, no, this is what you're going to do, and so he signed it, but it was one of those classic sort of mistakes were made kind of apology, like not taking ownership at all, and so, you know, that's another thing we talk about with reparations. There's the truth-telling, there's the open public official laying it out, but then there's the remorse, the apology, right, by the government, hopefully. So maybe, Kathy, give us a sense of, like, what a real apology might have sounded like, or either of you. I don't want to put you on the spot, but, well, you know, what are we talking about for a real apology?
Yeah, the fact that he said mistake, and people still in our own community sometimes say mistake. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a mistake. Mm-hmm. It was very deliberate. There were reasons for it, as we said earlier. Mm-hmm. And so we have to avoid saying, get away from that. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they didn't, we had asked for an apology, compensation, making a community fund, education was a big part of it, and changing the laws on the books so that it would overturn, that it couldn't happen again, we thought. Mm-hmm. The apology and the compensation, the $20,000, and the education fund were the only things that were actually established. Mm-hmm. And the education fund was from $50 million, which wasn't very much, down to $5 million. Right. And we all had to sort of create our own materials and get it into wherever we could get it in. So again, the education portion, if this country were really serious, it would have done a massive education project and campaign to make sure that people knew what had happened and that, you know, that it wouldn't happen again.
Right, because even where it is taught, whether I was a history major, American history major at a big American college, and all we learned was basically that mistakes were made and that there was a civil rights had to be suspended, you know, because of wartime, this and that. And, you know, that's what you're told in the history book, and if you don't know any better, you believe it, you know? But it's, obviously the government didn't have a real interest in actual education.
We want to talk about some of the lessons we can learn and some of the connections between Japanese American and Black folk. You know, historically, there's been much more focus on how Asian Americans and Black Americans have been divided, right, than how we've worked together for various reasons. I mean, really rooted in a sort of divide and conquer kind of mentality. But how did both of you come to advocate for Black reparations, and why is it so important to you?
a lot because of Kathy and this generation, the Sansei activists who came out of the movements of the 60s and 70s and taught me. It was through my own community that I got to learn more about these cycles of oppression, right? These ways in which, to the point of no mistakes, it's these are all very deliberate ways that the government, this is how the government does its work. Mm-hmm. And this is how power remains and maintains mm-hmm. itself. So none of these things are, oops, mm-hmm. what were we, you know, we fell into the concentration camps, we fell into genocide, we fell into family separation, we fell into enslavement. So, you know, so all these things are mm-hmm. I think I was learning about how our history was tied to a much larger history, right? A much larger struggle. And through that, I was also learning about solidarity. Mm-hmm. You know, and how we just looked at those hearings. They're like 26 hours worth of these hearings. And so if you really watch them all, you'll see how much we did not do it on our own.
Right.
I think we generally know that we cannot, no one community can gain mm-hmm. justice on its own. But it was really very clear. We always want to talk about Mervyn Dimely, who Mia Iwatake was a staffer for, met him at a community forum, and he wanted to know more about what the issue was and introduced some of the first pieces of legislation for Japanese American redress.
A local black politician.
Yes, yeah. And brought in the Congressional Black Caucus.
Right.
There were so many people in different parts of the country from so many different communities showing up to testify in favor, in support.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that learning that spoke a lot to me about how it's not, we didn't do it by ourselves. Mm-hmm.
And Kathy, you know, last year you testified at the U.S. Congress on behalf of H.R. 40.
Right.
So that's amazing. And, you know, maybe you can tell us just a little bit about what that experience was like to go to Congress and testify to them.
Well, I didn't have to go to Congress. Because it was during COVID, so it was on Zoom.
Fair enough.
But I still felt like I was there, and I was the one non-black person testifying that day. There was both pro and con, and I had 24 hours to prepare because actually I was taking the place of Norman Mineta, who had gotten ill, and then our other friend Alan Nisho couldn't do it, so it sort of fell on me.
Kind of like last minute.
24 hours to prepare for this.
No pressure.
But we had already been preparing sort of ideas and our position, so fortunately it took from that. It was a great experience. I was very honored to be able to testify, but I want to say that on that same day, there were 300 testimonies from Japanese Americans across the country that were submitted in support of reparations. So I wasn't standing there
mm-hmm.
alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to say that many of our friends are here who are part of the movement for redress and reparations. And you know, and I just want to add to what Tracy said earlier, that coming out of the 60s and 70s movement, we carried that perspective of third world solidarity and unity with us. You know, we were sort of a natural thing that we always felt our communities were connected in what we were doing.
Yeah.
And when there was opportunity, we would then also support issues like anti-apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that connection, saw that it was important, and tried to bring that up to our community so that they would understand. I'm learning now that there's a lot of history of solidarity that we didn't know about from the first generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there's even more than what I'm learning, but you know, the alliance of the Carlotta Bass, of the Eagle, supporting Japanese Americans fight against the alien land law.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Robeson speaking out against the camps.
Right.
And
yeah.
Japanese Americans supporting his concerts. There's a lot of that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you both talked about solidarity, and I think it's safe to say that's a bad word in the history books. And, you know, there's no question that racial solidarity is always terrifying to the powers that be, to the federal government, you know, to the people pulling the strings. It's terrifying, right? So why are they so scared?
Well, I think it's also the word solidarity. I'm like waiting to hear it on the news, you know? I go to my mom's house, and she always has like network news on. And I just think media is a part of this as well.
Sure.
And so media loves to talk about our divisions, violence between our communities. And I'm like, where's the follow-up? Where's the follow-up on the events that we attended just today, where you see so many different people working together? Where's the follow-up in terms of all of our people like actually showing up physically in support of each other's issues, testifying, getting on phone calls, mailing letters, whatever it is, like, you know, even internationally, we have so much solidarity, like, between, like, Japanese freedom fighters and the Palestinian movement. So there's so much that, again, we never, ever talk about. And, but, yes, to your point, it makes so much sense because we're not even supposed to be sitting here having this conversation, right? We were not supposed to have had that moment where people were testifying in public. Because again, we talk about these pilgrimages that we make to concentration camps in homage and in commemoration of what happened. That was, none of this was given to us by the government. The government wasn't like, oh, you know what? We totally wronged you. We're gonna issue an apology. And you know what? Well, hey, hey, let's like give you some money too. No. They didn't say, oh, we should turn Manzanar into a national historic site. Oh, you should remember. No, they locked the gates. It was our community that had to go in and find it, first of all. They were on the other side of the road, found out by the locals that they were, that the so-called, the, what they called it, the Jap camp, was on the other side of the road. And so people had to excavate. Our own community had to find itself.
Physically.
And by that, encouragement, nudging, suggestions, education, inspiration from other communities, from Black leaders, right? To say, you need to, if you're going to contribute to this movement, you should know also about your own history. So all these folks were like talking to each other, figuring each other's histories out, right? So I think, it serves the powers that be for us to never talk about the ways in which we're fighting for justice, the ways in which we need each other to do it. And we just continue on sort of these other issues, these other aspects of like the model minority myth, which I like to quote Susan Hayase up in San Jose. She calls it the model minority strategy. It's a wedge, right? It's purposeful. And our own communities buy into it. No, we're fine. We're the good Americans, right? So there's always this like tension between good American and bad American.
And the myth is not only good American, but obedient and...
Obedient, and successful, bootstraps. We worked hard. We value education more than you know
black
what
folk
I mean?
And
So it's like, you know, I think about that all the time, the ways in which these huge concepts get written about, talked about, discussed, covered in the media, and it's very useful to just constantly have these wedges between us. And so,
There's something I want to ask you guys about, this kind of weird thing of this paradox on reparations, which we see come up when we talk about black reparations too, which is, on the one hand, right, there was this bogus apology, there was an amount of money that all living survivors got. That's about it, right? Even the education fund didn't do what it was supposed to do. And so it seems like not nearly enough in all the important ways. And yet, like you talked about your grandmother, and you know, a lot of people have talked about how, you know, it meant so much to so many people. It was a really big deal, the symbolism, if nothing else, and the reality of the check. So How do we hold both those things at the same time, right? When you're struggling for reparations and,
What can I just say? I think thinking about my grandma, like we can never forget the bigger picture of harm. She was a very forgiving person. But clearly, like when her husband signed no to the agreement, he was adamant, and he did leave.
Tell folks what that is, by the way.
So there was in a nutshell, there was a loyalty questionnaire that was issued because the government was trying to drum up reasons, big part, they were trying to figure out ways in which to, like, end these camps because they knew they were in trouble. These were wrong. So they thought if they could get more people from our community to volunteer for the draft. They could show the greater America that we were loyal, and then we could get these folks out of these camps. So they issued these really terrible loyalty questionnaires, particularly these two questions that asked if you would serve in the army and asked if you would forswear allegiance to the Emperor of Japan. You can see how offensive that is, right, to folks who are like, I was born here, I don't even know the emperor, what are you talking about? And then people like my grandfather, who's like, you won't let me have any rights. I can't do anything here.
Right.
If I sign this, do I have no country? You know? And so he left. There were many people who signed no-no. There were a much smaller group who actually finally left. And my grandpa was one of those. My Pachan, my grandma, she was like, you go. This is my country. Most of the kids were born here. We're here. Bye-bye. So they separated. So that's a thing. Like, yeah, no, it's a great picture, right? You see the newspaper. You see this old Bachan in a wheelchair with her smile and this forgiveness. And that's why I say bittersweet, because it's like we can never forget the larger context.
Right. Well, Tracy, maybe you can give us some final words on your take on the connection between Japanese-American redress and black reparations. In whatever words or form you'd like to share.
Yeah, I thought I would read bits from this piece that I have in the book. Throughout the book, there are like notes to self, notes to community, notes to world. But I really felt it was important to have two sections addressing directly the Nikkei community, the Japanese American community. One on comfort women, and also one on reparations. So maybe that's a way I can convey some of my, my thoughts. So this is NTNC, which is Note to Nikkei Community.
You have a lot of abbreviations in this book, by the way. It's amazing.
There is a key
in
the back.
You learn the language eventually.
There are so cool. Tips, you know. But yes. No, there's some people who are like, no, I'm not looking at it. I'm going to figure them out. But it's so, I can't remember sometimes. Note to Nikkei Community on Reparations. As guided by legacy organizations, organizers, scholars, and other leaders of black communities steering the movement to reckon with the harms of slavery, Jim Crow, and pervasive systems, policies, and institutions of racism that still thrive today. Please, Nikkei JA family, when our black community members, including our black Nikkei folks, ask us to speak up for redress and reparations, say yes. Stand up and say yes. Give yourself permission to imagine real, feasible, actionable, and concrete elevations in our institutions and systems. Imagine us, a country, being able to experience justice and peace that is so deep because when it mattered, the people calling for it were listened to and their calls were heeded at impossibly long last. As a person who wasn't incarcerated, but as a child and grandchild of those incarcerated at Manzanar and Tule Lake, I learned when I was a kid that there once was a time before camp reunions and pilgrimages and monuments and former American concentration camps gaining the designation of National Historic Site. Let us always remember the government did not give us any of it. We had to go out and excavate our own memories. We had to find our history and fight for the revelation of our narratives. They meant to lock up the camps and all evidence and have us go on without acknowledging the pain of our existence, without justice, without healing. That was not possible. Our Sansei generation had to find out who they were in order to move forward, and they uncovered history, and they unlocked a reckoning. We are not the moral authority on mass incarceration, mass removal, or collective infliction of oppression onto one community. We are linked to a larger cycle of struggle and also a legacy of resistance and solidarity. We have stood up to white supremacy time and again. Let our lessons learned from redress and reparations for Japanese Americans serve to remind us that we were once told it was impossible, that it would never happen, that it was part of what happens at a time of war, or that the camps were not even that bad, or it was necessary and good for us. Let us remember that leadership came from within and had the solidarity of countless other people and communities in order for justice to come to fruition. Let us remember we demanded the respect of being able to lead our own movement. Let us not only support reparations because we once won a battle for redress. Let us do it because it is the right thing to do, because it is an imperative toward healing, because we are being called upon, because in our deepest core, we know we must say yes in order for the healing of all. Let us remember we will never truly breathe whole breaths as whole beings, as a whole country and people, until we reach a collective reckoning and repair. Until we become whole and so can exhale into a place of healing at the depths of the blood and marrow in our bones. Imagine that breath.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Tracy. We are in a moment going to have you guys be featured. We're going to have a Q&A session with our amazing guests. And so be thinking about some good questions. We'll pass the mic around. I want to give a quick shout out to an old and dear friend, Dee Hayashi, who's here tonight, who, there she is, who we worked together for many, many years. And I knew that Dee's parents were both incarcerated in different camps at that time and eventually met through some amazing coincidences here in Los Angeles, where they weren't from. But what I didn't know was that Dee went to Fairfax High School and has danced on this stage in high school folk dancing class.
Dee,
I can ask you to.
Come on, Dee.
Come up. You're off the hook for tonight.
Okay.
But thanks for being here, Dee.
All right, so we are moving to the Q&A. We will get to as many questions as we can before Muhammad and team kick us out of here. So,
do you think the fact that the Japanese community settled for $20,000 for what happened to you, the horror of what happened to you during World War II, has created a low bar?
Yeah, I hear
for us to be able to
climb. For sure.
Yeah. And definitely should not be used as a, because look at them, you say that when you're helping us, all right, for sure.
And we definitely do always say it was a token amount of money. We always try to make sure that we say that for sure.
And you want to talk on the affirmative action?
I do want to say a little bit about the affirmative action piece. Because to me, that is such a clear example of yet again how our community is being used to be that wedge and to drum up very specific examples of information and people to speak. And why do they do that? Because again, they want everyone, all of us, to internalize that and buy into the, well, see, these are the good ones, these are the bad ones, right? And this is what you need to do, right? All these myths, they're all strategies, right? They're all tactics, they're all wedges. There are so many Asian American organizations and organizers across the country who have been showing up and trying to get their voices out there, but will the media cover that? No.
So I'm Tony's sister. And I'm really proud of you, bro. I'm proud of you, Adam. And I didn't know if Tony was going to share this story, but since he did, I will. Our father, when he came home from the war, was walking down the street in L.A. and saw an elderly Japanese man prying wooden like bars off of a church, and he approached the gentleman and said, "Do you need help?" And he said, "Yes, this was my church. I just got out of a concentration camp and I want to see what's left." And so they worked all day, got the bars off and went inside, and it had been vandalized and badly broken up, but they set about getting it back together. And that was our family church, and my parents got married there, and we were raised in that church, and the executive director of that church, Al Peoples, is here now.
Oh,
so the idea of unity really does make a lot of sense. Yeah.
Hey, so it's me, the poet, but also the professor, and I have a question for Tracy, but for anybody. We know the media won't tell the story of solidarity, and we know that we can't rely on our governments to tell the story of solidarity. We can't rely on anything that is influenced by colonialism, white supremacy, to tell the story the way it is. And so one of the first ways I ever learned of Black and Japanese American solidarity surrounding anything was through literature, through a novel about South Los Angeles, about the Crenshaw District, about internment, about the riots, both in the 60s and the 90s. I mean, literally, I had to read it in fiction first to then seek it out in nonfiction. And I learned about internment, I learned about incarceration, but it was so separate from the history that I learned about myself as a Black person in LA. So anyway, I'm wondering, how else can we sneak this information in, right? So we're in California where we're not facing as large of a battle against book bans, a battle for book bans, but we are facing it. How can we get this information at the ground level, maybe to children early? We know the Education Fund did not fund proper education, but what can we do? Is it through literature like Tracy's book? Is it through conversations like this? How do we do this? And maybe how are we already doing this? And then how can we duplicate and make it so maybe not mandatory, but so ever present that people forget they're learning the truth, right? That it's not fiction. Like, oh no, this is actually real. It's kind of like folks learning about Africa and thinking Wakanda is a real place. It's like, no, but actually it's not. But there are real places. Do you want to go look? Like that kind of thing. What can we do?
Small question.
I mean, I have a million answers to that, Bridget. Also, thank you so much for being here. Yeah. Bridget, I think, you know, one thing I always think about is how I learned in my 20s from some really excellent international organizers who were doing a lot around trafficking and global economy issues with the World Bank and talking a lot about imperialism. And so they were always talking about a huge, broad ideology. But they were very clear every time they would speak that they're like, look, mass organizing is building relationships one at a time. Never forget that. And I never forgot that. And I believe so much in that. I believe so much in study. I believe you are doing everything that you should be doing as an educator, as an artist. Bridget, I think you and I should go to Florida together. You know what I mean? Like, and bring all of our LA poets with us. I think we need to be doing as much as we can, and you already are, you know? And us being here, us showing up. I'm changed. I hope we're all gonna leave here somehow changed. And I believe in that. I believe the more we build relationships, the more we study, you just can't turn your back on it. It just is going to keep building. So I believe in that. I know Kathy has a lot to say too.
Well, on the theme of relationship, I do want to say that I learned a lot from being at All Peoples. I was a teacher in LA Unified at a continuation high school that was at All Peoples. Met Tony. Tony came and brought people to teach our students. But All Peoples has an amazing history of solidarity and of different people working together that people don't all know about. And, you know, those are the, I don't think we could, I was a school teacher, we can't rely on the schools. We know that. We can't rely on the schools to teach this. You know, it's up to the individual teacher, they're all different, and also we can't even count on the rules being followed or whatever, rules. Laws changing about things, it's just too much of a fight. We have to have our own schools. We do have to teach our own, in our own community.
All right, we got a question in the deep corner. Yeah.
Firstly, I just want to say thank you guys for all the information, the wealth of knowledge that you guys have shared tonight. Very informative. Hello, everybody. My name is Christian. I'm a graduate at UCLA. So very happy to have this conversation about reparations. This might be a little bit of a broad question, so I know I'm not going to get a clear-cut answer, but that's perfectly fine. And that question would be, what are the, just based off of your, I guess, like, your level of expertise and, like, just your opinions, what do you think are institutional reparations that can be given towards the Black American and the Japanese American community. I know that we talked a little bit earlier about like the monetary form of reparations, which is perfectly, you know, that's necessary. But I think when we talk about the greater concept of reparations, that's not sufficient. You know, it was the institution that didn't allow Black and Japanese Americans to own property. It was the institution that, you know, pretty much classified as a second-class citizen. So what are some, I guess, policy ideas or just some tangible institutional reparations that you guys have in mind? And this is open to anybody as well, so.
Yeah. Actually not. I'm sorry.
I take that back.
Sorry about that. I mean, we all can chop it up afterwards, but Muhammad's saying we gotta wrap this up, so. So we got right here.
Well, you know, we mentioned this a little bit earlier, but I do think we've learned a lot about the vision and the strength and possibility of wild thinking and wild policy change and wild systemic change by studying the reparations movement now. So if you look at the Movement for Black Lives Toolkit, or if you go on any number of the legacy organizations' websites, they'll break down the ways in which they see the main calls for what reparations could be. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the things, you know, like cessation, guarantees of non-repetition is something that we hone in on a lot in our study, in our discussions, because guarantees of non-repetition, right, of a harm as huge, like egregious as slavery, right, and Jim Crow, that is absolutely going to require structural changes, right? Policy, institutional changes.
Right, yeah. And actually, you know, the California Task Force, right, just issued their recommendations. So all of those involve policy changes and institutional changes.
I think that's a great question, and I was going to say exactly what Kathy said, that the California Task Force has really done an amazing job of just breaking down different sectors of our society and how they need to be changed. Healthcare, education, jobs, how everything works. Right. So it's a great place to start. We'll have links in the show notes to that because it's some late-breaking stuff.
Were we lying or were we telling the truth about these folks? Right? Yeah.
Thank you, Tony.
No. So,
Adam. Yeah, thank you.
Big thanks to the Greenway Court Theater family. So Muhammad, Eric, Jasmine, Renee, thank you all.
Bridget Bianca
in the house, yes.
Tony Tolbert.
Hold on. We also need to give a credit to the folks who supplied the video clip. Actually, Kathy and Tracy hooked it up, but Visual Communications, Nikkei for Civil Rights and Redress, and the Japanese American National Museum for that very powerful video clip, and that will be in the show notes as well, a link to that.
And before you get out of here, Muhammad gave you a stern warning about the 30 minutes. You do have 30 minutes, and all three, Bridget's book, Tracy's book, and Kathy's, the NCRR's amazing book on the history, for sale in the lobby tonight, so
yes.
Check it out.
Yes. Thank all of you for coming out.
Thank you.
Keep coming back.
That was incredible. I mean, Kathy and Tracy brought some thunder and broke some stuff down for us.
They definitely did. Yeah, so much information and so just powerful and moving the stories they told. What stood out to you most?
You know, there were several points that really impacted me, but one key takeaway is how reparations will almost always have some paradoxical aspects to it, right?
Yeah.
That you can almost never do enough to really redress and repair what happened.
Right.
But it's
least,
also...
Or at least get the government to do that, right?
Exactly. Right. I mean, the government's only going to go so far, mm-hmm. even with pushing and prodding. Mm-hmm. And so while that's a reality, and in the case of, you know, Japanese-American reparations, you know, didn't go nearly far enough. But at the same time, it was also vital and critically, you know, important, right, that the government actually did take some responsibility and, mm-hmm. and some accountability. So, you know, the $20,000 that the folks who were in prison, you know, received was, you know, token, right? Some, but it was something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The, you know, apology that, you know, President Reagan, you know, issued, which was somewhat of a pseudo apology, you know, wasn't full throated, but that also meant something, right? That the people heard the government say, yeah, we messed up. We shouldn't have done this.
Definitely.
You know, Tracy talked about her grandmother, who was 101 and wheelchair bound, who flew out to D.C. to actually, you know, receive her check in person, and that you can't underestimate the power of symbolism, you know, with things like this, that it's tangible, but it's also intangible.
Another big thing we learned was just the power of people telling their truths and having it be a formal public thing. Right. Kathy talked about how at first people in the movement didn't really want to have hearings. It was going to slow things down. It was going to be bogus. But in the end, it ended up being super powerful to get everybody out there and, you know, telling stories that have been buried for so long and all the emotion behind it. It made it be real.
Yeah. Real, real.
It's another great lesson that, you know, to have reparations, we need a formal official reckoning, and stuff has to be brought out for everybody to see. Let's get some headlines and let's tell the truth for everyone to hear.
Yeah, let's tell the truth, you know, out in open and in public. And if we're going to repair the damage, we need to acknowledge the damage, and not halfway, but all the way.
Right.
You know, and you know, another real key takeaway from this episode and from what we learned from Kathy and Tracy is that, you know, reparations isn't going to happen by itself. Right.
Right.
It's not going to happen because our government one day wakes up and says, you know what? You know, we're wrong. We've been wrong. you know, we need to make this right.
Never going to happen.
Never. You know, never in this lifetime or any other lifetime. So the government's not giving away anything on its own. Right.
Right.
Government did not give Japanese American, reparations without a demand.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's, you know, Frederick Douglass's, you know, key line is power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and never will.
Right.
And so, you know, we must keep demanding, must keep fighting, must keep persisting if we're serious about seeing reparations done.
Yeah. And like we were talking about with Kathy and Tracy, racial solidarity is one of the biggest fears of the powers that be and of our federal government. And there's a reason why they don't want everybody to get together and, you know, join forces, because that's when things happen. That's when change can happen. So we will have some great stuff in the show notes on this episode. There's a lot more about the fight for Japanese American reparations. There's an amazing searchable list of the more than 125,000 people who were imprisoned by name. There's links to all the hearings testimony, a lot more than what we heard on the show. And Tracy's incredible book of poetry and more, and lots of other resources on the history if folks want to read up more on that.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us on Pay the Tab. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please subscribe to our podcast. And if you like what we're putting down, share it with your family and friends.
And please give us a review on Apple Podcasts. This is the best way you can help us to get the word out with this show. So please check that out and give us some love.
Thanks for listening. Keep coming back to Pay the Tab.
Time to pay the tab.